Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Bob Crawford is a founding member of a local band that paid its dues and gradually gained fame for their signature blend of bluegrass, rock, folk, and Americana. Eventually, one of their albums, Mignonette, would serve as the basis for the acclaimed, though short-lived, Broadway musical Swept Away. Of course, I'm talking about the Avett Brothers, and Bob Crawford has played a pivotal role in creating and contributing to their sound. But outside of music, Crawford has another interest that he's used as the foundation for a podcast, American History Hotline.
You've reached American History Hotline. You ask the questions.
What is political technology?
Did George Washington really cut down a cherry tree?
Were JFK and Marilyn Monroe having an affair?
We get the answers.
I'm so glad you asked me this question.
This is such a ridiculous story
that we tell ourselves because we don't want to know the real story.
Leave a message.
Hey there, American History Hotliners. Your host, Bob Crawford here. Happy to be joining you again for another episode of American History Hotline. You're the ones with the questions. I'm a guy trying to get you some answers.
Bob Crawford joins us now to talk about his podcasts, I should say, make that plural, his interest in history and, of course, about music. Welcome back, Bob. Good to see you again.
Mike, it's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Oh, thank you. This is not the first podcast that you've been involved in. It isn't even the first history-based podcast that you've been involved in. You co-host a podcast called The Road to Now with an historian. You also hosted a podcast called Founding Son, John Quincy's America. So where does this interest in history come from? You're a musician.
Yeah, I think history probably predates music, I guess. It could go hand in hand, because history I remember from being in fourth grade. I had a fourth grade teacher, school teacher, and looking back on it, I'm pretty sure she was a historical interpreter, which I think she made her own clothes. Like, you know, we would call them reenactors. Some people call them reenactors. The more you learn about this world of history, this public historians, they are historical interpreters. And I think that's maybe where it came from. And my mother, we lived in South Jersey, and we had a couple historic sites there. We had this town of Smithville, and it was, you know, I'm sure of historical buildings from the 18th and early 19th century that they probably put in one place, you know, like they created a little historical town. And my mother would take me there when I was very young. And then we had an iron ore, we had a Batstow, which was an iron ore mine. And it was, I came in my adult years, I came to learn it was owned by Nathaniel Greene, who was one of George Washington's top generals. So I had it, you know, it was around me. And another recollection I have from that time period was going on family vacations. And everybody packed into, this is the 70s, right? The late 70s. We all packed into our station wagon, and we would go to Disney World, or we would go to Williamsburg, Virginia, or Busch Gardens in Virginia, coming down from Jersey, and we would stop at the rest area, and there would be these pamphlets for all the local historic sites. There's a little kiosk with the little pamphlets, and I would collect those, and I would get home, and I would lay them out on the floor, and I would like just look at them, and I really, you know, the past couple of years, I've had that question come to me a lot, and when I think about it, I think that's where it started.
I mentioned your podcast, Founding Son, John Quincy's America. That podcast about the second president's son, who became the sixth president of the United States, is about, as I understand it, is about to become a book for release, I think, early next year. Is that correct? Is that still on track?
Yeah, March 10th is what we're looking at, March 10th, 2026.
How do you have time?
Well, you know, in an odd way, being a touring musician is conducive for this, and it's healthy. It makes all the downtime, because we have a lot of downtime, right? It's a lot of traveling to get to where you want to get to where you're going to be, get to where you're going to work. And then it's a lot of hurry up and wait. And early on, and this was another probably pretty influential time period, was 2001, 2000 to 2010, when we were in a van. We were traveling like 6, 7, 8 hours a day in a conversion van, and then later a 15 passenger van. I just started reading history books, you know, and so I would spend, 5, 6, 7 hours a day reading. And that's kind of this right now, everything that I'm doing is kind of a continuation of what began then. It all started then. This has been like this long journey of becoming a historian, for lack of a more specific term of what I am, a hybrid historian. But I mean, you know, this has been, you know, 20 years in the making, really.
This John Quincy Adams podcast and your book, which is forthcoming, looks at a guy that probably gets short shrift, even though he was a president, because his father was the second president and a founding father and a contributor to the Declaration of Independence, etc. But you look at John Adams and his changing views on slavery, a guy you described as standing in the breach between the founding fathers and the American Civil War. And it's part of a period of our history, I guess, that a lot of people would like to whitewash, forget about it. What would you say to those who advocate that approach, who want to remember only the good things in American history and forget about the bad?
We need to embrace and hold within ourselves the good, the bad, and the ugly of American history. We can do it. You know, it's not your fault if you are a white person in 2025, you know, you don't need to carry the guilt of slavery or the shame of enslaving people. You don't need to do it. But what you do need to do is understand that it happened. And the period that I write about and study the most is 1820 to 1860, really, 1820, 1850 for John Quincy Adams. He died in 1848. But imagine waking up in the morning and not being able to fathom slavery would not exist, right? Mm-hmm. That's what people in the 1820s, 30s, 40s, 50s, there was no reason to conceive that slavery would not always exist, right? It was society. It was the way it was. And just as if, let's say, some people out there don't believe that an ordinary citizen should own an AR-15, right? Let's say that that's a belief that someone holds. Mm-hmm. Well, there's no reason in your mind to conceive at this moment that there will be a day when nobody owns an AR-15. There, you know, and so I'm not equating the two, other than there was a time in this country where we could not conceive that slavery would be ended, and no one could imagine how it would be ended. And that was something that draws me to John Quincy Adams.
And then some of our most famous and most revered figures in American history, these historical figures, the founding fathers, and even more, would not pass muster. Their ideas, their thoughts, their practices would not pass muster today with our current standards, and some people want them canceled. They certainly don't want them honored in any significant way, and that includes some very important people in our history, including Thomas Jefferson, because he was, as you say, an owner of enslaved people. But you also say, quote, we need to remember that historical figures are and were human beings, and so they are complicated. Each of us holds darkness and the light deep down inside of us. And in an interview that you gave, you said that after telling a story about George Washington that I'd never heard before, about his attempts to recapture an escaped slave. You still honor George Washington. So tell that story, because I had never heard that story before about our first president.
Well, it's a great book about an enslaved woman named Ona Judge. And when we go to break, I'll look up the author's name so I can credit her. But Washington had an escaped enslaved woman, and he used his celebrity, his power, to try to get her back. He never did. But in fact, there was a fugitive slave law passed during his administration, and he subverted it. He obstructed justice to try to re-enslave this woman, and he failed. But he also gave up power after serving two terms as president. You know, I mean,
which is something King George said if he did it, he would never happen. But if he did it, he'd be the greatest man in history. That's actually in Hamilton, and it's true.
Right. It's true. It's very true. And so everything that we, all the precedents of the presidency that make us special, right? Ken Burns, I recently saw him, and he said, Ecclesiastes, there's nothing new under the sun. He's like, that was true, except for once, when we became the United States of America, you know, July 4th, 1776. For the first time, human beings went from being subjects to being citizens. And that was a new thing. And that is a new thing.
Yeah.
We need to hold on to it. And so Washington, they were all incredibly flawed. Look, I just played a game at the beach, and it was one of these, it was like table talk, and you pull a card out and they ask a question. Essentially, the question was, would you vote for, and I'm really simplifying it, would you vote for a serial philanderer who cheated on his wife and had several, you know, affairs? Would you vote for someone who drank a fifth of bourbon every day? Or would you vote for someone who, you know, didn't commit so-and-so, such-and-such crimes or this and that? And it was essentially like Roosevelt was the serial philanderer, and Winston Churchill was the alcoholic, and Hitler was the one who was blameless. As this card read it, I'm thinking, well, I think I have to go back and look at it, but I do believe Hitler went to jail for something for a while. But it just reiterates this point of that human beings are flawed and failed in many ways, but every once in a while they get it right.
How do we, through our modern eyes, without compromising our own beliefs, our own morals, our own principles, grant grace to these people who came before us, who are diametrically opposed to our beliefs and still accomplished great things? How do we deal with that in our own minds? I have about 40 seconds.
No, I think it's a matter of holding those diametric thoughts, those opposing thoughts and feelings together, and just sitting with them. I mean, I really think it's a matter of just like being with it and acknowledging it. And we don't have to, I guess we feel like we need some kind of grand gesture, either a gesture of condemnation or a gesture of elevation. And I think it's just holding the good and the bad together and just being with it.
Bob Crawford is our guest today. He's the bassist for the Avett Brothers, but he's also the host of several history-based podcasts, the latest of which is called American History Hotline. We'll talk about that and other things when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Bob Crawford is our guest, a member of the Avett Brothers Band, also I guess you would call him a semi-professional but amateur historian, because he hosts several podcasts based in history, some with historians and all with the help of historians, to get answers to questions that people have about American history, the latest of which is called American History Hotline. I'm still talking about John Quincy Adams, our sixth president and the son of the second president. I haven't read your book yet because it hasn't come out yet, and it won't until March. But the publicity around that book, remarks on Quincy Adams' advocacy for the anti-slavery cause and his historic 72-day takeover of the congressional floor. I think I'm right about 72 days. That seems like an extraordinary amount of time. I think he's the only president ever to become a member of Congress after his term as president ended. So talk about that 72-day takeover. What was that about?
Well, I think what you're referring to was actually about 3 weeks. It was about 2.5 weeks. Okay. And they had this thing called the morning hour, which was a set aside time for debating certain topics. And this was when the debate over should we annex Texas was hot. And this is like 1830, I think it's the summer of 1838, June, July, going into July, the July 4th recess, last few weeks of the congressional session. And there was a foreign affairs committee. So what happened with Adams was, this was a time when citizens, the only real way to lobby your congressman or to petition the government for redress of grievances, which is articulated in the First Amendment, clause right. of the First Amendment, you would send a petition to your congressman or to a congressman. And there was time set aside in the congressional calendar when congressmen would read petitions from citizens. And those petitions would be printed sometimes. They would be acted upon in some way. They would be sent to the most relevant committee, or they would be tabled, which means they're Adams would say, they would sleep the sleep of death. And so in 1836, Southern congressmen, with the help of their Northern allies, passed what became known as the gag rule. They were receiving so many anti-slavery petitions that they got sick. They were just annoyed by them. Southern congressmen were annoyed by them. And so they passed a rule where these petitions would just go right to being tabled. They would not even be read. And that is what really stoked Adams' ire, and it pulled him into the fight, because he was not an abolitionist. But this was, now you're taking away the freedom of speech of the citizens. You take away the freedom of speech, you take away the freedom of religion, you take away the freedom to peaceably assemble. What are you doing to the Constitution? And that brought him into the fight. So in 1838, when it was hot and heavy about, do we bring Texas into the Union? Well, the big fear, if you were a Northerner, was, and this was not just about slavery, this was about power, right? You bring in a state as large as Texas, you can carve it into 5 new slave states, which means 10 new Southern congressmen. Look, what are they doing in Texas right now? Exactly. They're talking about redistricting. Why? To get more seats. Why? What's it matter to get more seats? More seats, more Republican seats is more Republican power. And no different, this is why I love history, no different in 1838. And so all these petitions were coming in against the annexation of Texas, and they were being taped. They were able to get them sent to the Foreign Relations Committee. And then states began to send in resolutions to the Congress for and against the annexation of Texas. Those two went to the Foreign Relations Committee. Foreign Relations Committee says, you know what? We're not going to do anything with this. President said he's not going to annex Texas right now. We're not going to do anything like this. Adams catches them because he knew the rules so well. they had to, by the rules of the House, at least read those petitions, at least consider them. And some of the committeemen for the Foreign Relations Committee admitted they had not even looked at them. And so that gave Adams the ability to, you know, submit a motion, and he gained the floor. He held the floor for 2 weeks. He essentially pulled everything out of the hat, from secret intelligence he was getting about what Southern congressmen in cahoots with the Texas government. And he would even brought things in like women's rights. He just held the floor for 2 weeks and really held everybody hostage. At the end of that 2 weeks, the press for the Van Buren administration was so bad, they were like, we're not, to hell with Texas for now. We're just going to leave it alone. And he kind of, because of that, we put off annexing Texas for another 7 years.
We could talk about John Quincy Adams forever, and it's kind of interesting that we've even been able to talk about him this long, because the first three presidents, the big three, Washington, Adams, the father, Adams, and Jefferson get all the spotlight, followed, I guess, by Madison and Monroe. And then along comes John Quincy Adams, and that's when the spotlight begins to dim until his successor takes over, Andrew Jackson. And then after that, not so much until Abraham Lincoln. But evidently, John Quincy Adams, particularly when he was in Congress, was a mover and a shaker. And you credit him as playing the foundational role in the push for emancipation. You also call him our nation's greatest public servant and our original political maverick. Why don't people know this about him?
Well, because he was not one of our best presidents. That's why. I mean, you know, Adams, the beauty of Adams, or the importance of Adams and the relevance of Adams to today, is he was a former president who went into the Congress to continue serving his country. And he did that for 17 years. And while he was there, he brought the issue of slavery out into the open, and it made it the pitched battle, the battlefield, the hot issue in the country. And, you know, the events that were going on, of course, helped to dictate that. But his wealth of understanding, his intelligence, you know, like I say, he was practiced at the art of verbal jujitsu. He was, you know, a Harvard debater, you know, when he was young. He served two terms, maybe our best Secretary of State. Two terms of Secretary of State. He had been a diplomat. Washington appointed him to his first diplomatic post. He had served in the Senate. He went against his party while he served in the Senate, got kind of ran out of his seat, lost his seat because he went against his party in the Senate. And so he was minister to Russia. He, you know, just, he is our greatest. Public service was his, was the oxygen he breathed. And of course it was, because his parents were John and Abigail Adams.
That's right. So the book about John Quincy Adams will come out in March, and people who have been intrigued by this so far can read even more about that. I want to talk about some of the other history podcast that you indulge in. You started the Road to Now podcast, I think, in 2016.
May of 2016.
With Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. You're still doing it, I believe. You've recorded hundreds of episodes by now.
Yeah, over 300.
That's dedicated to explaining the history behind important events and to figure out what brought us to today. Recently, you've examined the global economy, past and present, Christian capitalism in the early American Republic, and how charisma played a role in shaping American history from the Puritans to Trump. And you do at least one of these episodes each and every week. Where do the topic ideas come from?
Well, now that we are in our 10th year of the Road to Now, we get, you know, people just like you, Mike, people come to us and say, hey, I've got an author here. I got a new book. Can we send you this book? You know, like, so people come to us, and that makes it, with our busy lives, like Ben's very busy as well. But so thankfully we have people that come to us. And then also, if we read a book, like, we'll have somebody on whose book came out 3 years ago. But if I discover the book and I read it, I'm like, oh man, I want to talk to this. Like, it really is very self-indulgent in that it's like, oh, this guy put this book out, you know, 8 years ago. Oh, I just read it. It's like, it's brand new to me. I love it. I love this topic. Hey, come on and talk about your book that you put out like eight years ago.
If it's new to you, it'll be new to many, if not all,
to somebody,
of your listeners. Yeah. But the part of the thrust of that Road to Now podcast is to figure out how we got to where we are today.
Yes.
Have you figured that out? Yes. What did bring us to where we are today? Because where we are today is pretty messed up.
The Road to Now is actually, here's what I've learned. The Road to Now is actually an ocean that is as deep as it is wide. It is complicated. If it is a road, in fact, it's winding. At some points, there's like, it's the old MapQuest. You would print up the MapQuest and it would take you, you know, to this, like this bridge, but the bridge actually had been washed out since 1942. And you have to go back like the Avits, like we would do back in the old days. We remember we were one time between New York State and Pennsylvania, and, you know, we drove 50 miles out of our way to cross a bridge that no longer existed, and then you had to go back. And so anyway, that's pretty much the historical Road to Now. Is it's a mess.
It's a mess.
But every event that happens is contingent on events that happen that precede it. You know, nothing just happens out of the blue. I am currently finishing a book by Sam Tannenhaus, a great new book about William F. Buckley, who was in the 20th century. He was the intellectual architect of the modern conservative movement, the movement that Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan. And, you know, the deeper I get into the book, the Trump administration, you know, Trump and Trumpism is still deeply embedded in the thought life and the decades of Firing Line and National Review, which still exists, that he started in like in the late 50s. But I'm just realizing how contingent the events of the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s were on today. Like what's happening today did not just fall out of the sky and fall upon us. It has been decades and decades in the works. And what happens tomorrow is in the works today. It's happening. We don't realize it. There are names we don't know, we've never heard, that are going to be relevant and crucial in the life of this nation in the years and decades to come. And so that is the beauty of the Road to Now.
But understanding that gives us a better feeling or understanding of where we are today, and maybe make people feel less adrift in this if they understand the underpinnings and can maybe begin to recognize what this may be leading us to. And I guess that kind of plays into this newest American History Hotline podcast, which just started and is made available by iHeartRadio. American History Hotline launched, I think, the beginning of July. And you ask listeners in this podcast for questions, and then you try to answer those questions with the help of other historians or experts.
Hi, this is Joseph from Eden Prairie, Minnesota. I heard that both Thomas Jefferson and John Adams died on the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. That sounds a little convenient. Did this really happen, or is it patriotic folklore?
Well, I have always heard that the answer is yes. Is that correct?
It is indeed correct. Yes, and they were not the only two presidents to die on a July 4th. They died on the same July 4th, which was the 50th anniversary of the signing of Declaration of Independence. And if you're looking for conspiracy theories, like, and you lived in 1826, well, just let your mind run wild with that. Or what does it mean for the, is it foreboding, or what does it mean, right? Yes, that is true that they died like 5 hours apart. Jefferson died first, one in the afternoon, and then later in the afternoon, John Adams died.
And is it true? Because Jefferson was the younger of the two, but they lived in different states, So there was no breaking news. There was no telephone alerts to tell you that a president had just died. And when Adams died, is it true that among his last words was the phrase, "At least Jefferson lives"?
Yeah, I believe it's Jefferson lives, Jefferson survives. Yeah, right. Yeah, those were his last words.
And is it true that John Quincy Adams' son, George Washington Adams, was kind of the witness to those last words? Is that true?
That is true. That is how we understand it. That's as best as I could surmise. Yes.
Wow.
And you imagine George Washington Adams, well, you know, John Quincy Adams really revered George Washington.
Clearly. So the truth about whether Adams and Jefferson died on July 4th was the question answered in the first episode of this new American History Hotline podcast. Other questions that you've already tackled include, would Lincoln be a Republican today? And does the Constitution prevent a dictator? Let's tackle the first one first. The political positions of both parties have shifted substantially over time, and sometimes back and forth and back and forth. So what is the answer? Would Lincoln be a Republican today, or would he be a Democrat?
Okay, so, you know, some of these questions are not, you really can't answer, right? Because we don't know. No, Lincoln would not be a Republican right this minute. No, I don't think so. And the expert, we get experts to help me kind of figure this out and help our guests get the answers that they're looking for. And the great Julian Zelizer, who's a Princeton historian and the author of many books, a CNN presidential historian, Julian Zelizer was the expert for that episode. Yeah, I really don't think Lincoln would be a Republican at this point.
I started with that question.
Mike, I don't think Ronald Reagan would be a Republican at this point.
Okay. I started with that first question because the second question requires some time to investigate. And the second question, for those who don't remember, was, does the Constitution prevent a dictator? I want to get into that with Bob Crawford when we come back. We're talking about his interest in American history, specifically now about his American History Hotline podcast, which premiered on July 1st. And we'll get into some other aspects of Bob's life and career as we go through the remainder of this hour. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. Their curriculum aims to develop curiosity among middle schoolers and help them foster skills like critical thinking, collaboration, problem solving, and social awareness. More at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Bob Crawford is with us, the Avett Brothers' longtime bassist, the guy who's responsible in many ways for getting them to tour, which means if they hadn't toured, they wouldn't be as popular or as famous as they are. Excuse me. So you can credit their success to Bob exclusively. He's also the host of several different history-based podcasts, the latest of which is the American History Hotline, which premiered in July on July 1st. And is distributed by iHeartRadio. The question that we are going to tackle now, which is, I think, the third or fourth question you tackled in this series, is, does the Constitution prevent a dictator? And you say, the answer to this question is one we may not like. Why?
Well, I mean, there are constitutional checks and balances, right? There are horizontal checks and balances, meaning the division of the branches of government. You have legislative, executive, and judicial, and then you have vertical checks and balances. And there are in the Constitution, there's the impeachment. You know, you can impeach a president, but that is kind of become, it's never kind of really worked the way it was, I guess, intended to work. I think the founders kind of put a lot of weight on the American people to make the decision of who was going to be the president. And at the time, the voters, the people who were, had the right to vote, who had the vote, they were the elite, right? They were the wealthy landowners, and that was, I don't think they saw the franchise. I don't think they saw the franchise to vote to being extended to everyone. Like democracy, like, you know, to be a republic is one thing, to be a democracy is something different. And we are right now, I mean, we are a unabashed, raw democracy. We are full on democracy, especially social media and the technological changes, Mike, that you and I have witnessed in our lifetimes. It has just made everything more democratic, what I mean is literally everyone has a say. And I've heard people refer to what we are living through as the attention economy. It's the attention economy, right? How many looks can you get?
What's going on with the Epstein files is a good example of that. Perhaps 20, 30 years ago, politicians would successfully have quashed that at some point, or it would have ruined a career or two or three. Right now, people aren't going to let it go.
Yeah, Mike, we would have never known about it.
Right.
Like with Kennedy and Eisenhower and their dalliances. And look, I'm not equating in any way, like, what Epstein did and Ghislaine Maxwell did doesn't even, like, can we rate these sins? I mean, no. Pedophilia, that's like at the top. So I'm not equating it, but we may not have known about it. Like, right. We really may not have known about it. So it's good that we know about it. Like, it's very good that we know about it.
So you spoke to get an answer to the question.
Jeffrey Rosen.
You spoke to Jeffrey Rosen, who is the CEO of the National Constitution Center, and he's an American legal scholar. And he told you that the framers of the Constitution were very worried about demagogues and dictators because they had just split from England because they considered King George to be a tyrant. It's in the Declaration. They call him a tyrant, which is why they designed this separation of powers, three equal branches of government,
right,
independent of each other. But that doesn't seem to be holding at the moment. There is this push towards strengthening the executive branch, the idea of a unitary executive who has the right to rule as he or she sees fit because they were elected. The Supreme Court has aided in the strengthening of that idea through some of their decisions, and Congress seems to be abdicating their role in this altogether. They're playing along. So the question becomes, for me at least, if this is happening now and the framers were worried about this, why hasn't it happened before?
Well, it has. I mean, not like it is today, but it happened, you know. Look, here's what I've learned. This is essentially what my book is about.
Okay.
Is that people say history, if you don't learn it, history repeats itself, right?
You don't know your history, you're doomed to repeat it.
Right. Okay. Or they say Mark Twain is attributed, and this may be apocryphal, but the saying, like, history doesn't repeat, it rhymes. Okay. That's closer. You know what I think? History doesn't repeat. History doesn't repeat. History doesn't rhyme. People don't change. We human beings have not changed since the beginning of time. Our technology, we've been gifted with the ability to think and to learn and to experiment and to come up with all these incredible technologies that I can be on the one side of the state, you're on the other side of the state, your listeners are all over the world, you know, and here we all are together, just like we're hanging out. We're all hanging out. I'm looking at you like you're sitting across from me.
Right.
So the technology has changed. But the people, when I was writing my book, I went like, oh, well, that's Matt Gaetz. That's John McCain. These are the same, we're the same people, right? We're the same people. So taking that, Andrew Jackson, who we mentioned earlier, who succeeded, who defeated, ended John Quincy Adams' reelection hopes. He assumed enormous executive powers for his time. Yeah. He assumed and more.
He's a hero to Donald Trump.
He's a hero to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
He's a hero to Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon told Donald Trump about him, and now he's a hero to Donald Trump. And so the things he did were at the time not unlike, you know, we're living it, right? So we're feeling it differently. The weapons of war are more, you know, are worse. The reach of the federal government is further, goes further and stronger and deeper in our lives. But you had a president who went to war against the banks, against the Bank of the United States. He killed the bank. He crushed the bank. He changed monetary policy in the United States as we knew it at the time. You had a Supreme Court justice in John Marshall who rules in favor of Native Americans, only to have, and this may be apocryphal as well, but I mean, the actions that he took, the Trail of Tears is true, but it's said that Andrew Jackson may have said, the Chief Justice has made his ruling, now let him enforce it.
Well, that gets that gets me to my next question, because in the course of doing this podcast with Jeffrey Rosen, in response to a question from you, he points out that the Supreme Court has the final word, but they don't have the power of the sword. They can't, and this has been a topic of conversation on talk shows on television now for months, they can't enforce their orders against a recalcitrant executive branch. And we've never faced that moment, except for Andrew Jackson, when the high court's decisions are ignored or just directly disobeyed. So what does that say when that happens? What happened to Andrew Jackson? What can we learn from that?
Well, what happened to Andrew Jackson was several other competing factions in the country came together to create an opposition party called the Whig Party. And after 8 years of Jackson and his destroying the Bank of the United States helped put us in a terrible, what they called at the time, a panic, which was like a depression, economic. We had, when his successor took over, poor Martin Van Buren, because by the time he took over, the Jackson administration policies had really wreaked havoc on the financial life, the economy of the United States. And so really after 12 years of Jacksonian governance, executive governments, the Americans got sick of it, and they changed. The Americans, what they wanted changed. They voted differently. They brought in other actors. The Congress also asserted themselves a lot more. They retook a lot of their power. Like you said here, you were like, yeah, there was Washington, Jefferson, and then And then Andrew Jackson, and then blah, 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 there was Abraham Lincoln. Well, blah, 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 blah was essentially weak executives, right? We had weak presidents. So we had a decade there or so where the president, the executive branch was weak, and the legislative branch and the judicial branches asserted themselves more. So right now we're living through a period where the executive branch is asserting itself. Now, have we ever seen such top-to-bottom party unity that we see in the Republican Party, where Trump says jump, they say how high, from the city councilman to the mayor to the state reps to the governor to the senator to the congressman? You know, it's pretty. I mean, he is running his party like a mob boss would runs his operation. So, you know, look, we don't know where this is going. So I'm not here to reassure anybody that it's going to be okay, because it's going to take a lot of shoe leather activism to get out of this.
Have we faced anything like this in the past, given what you know about history?
Well, in the past, we maybe not this exact thing, but we faced other things, right? Like, I mean, in the 1830s, you had mob violence. I'm not talking about like Al Capone, John Gotti mob violence, but you had mobs that were running amok throughout the country. There was the 1835, 1836. There's never in the history of our nation, the 1960s, the whatever you want to say, there was more mob violence committed on not just free blacks, but bankers. People would go in Baltimore. People would raid the home of a banker's house and pile up all their furniture and burn their house and burn their pile of furniture. I mean, there were mobs running amok. If a gambler came to Mississippi, they would run him out of town or hang him, and then they would get all worked up. Whenever there was a mob in this time period, they would go after what they were going after, either like the wealthy man in town, the banker, or the gambler who came to town, and then they would get all fired up, and then they would go to the free black part of town, and they would burn down the black part of town. So it just, you know, we haven't faced this, but we faced a lot of other things.
We're going to run out of time, and I don't want to run out of time before we address the another aspect of history and how it comes together with your other career, which is music. Yeah. You recently, I mean, years ago, the Avett Brothers album Mignonette dealt with a different kind of history. It wasn't American history at all. It was the history of an Australian ship going back to England in 1887 that hit some. Well, I guess it sank, and the sailors had to do what they had to do to survive. It became a Broadway show called Swept Away. How involved were you in the creation of the songs in the album that led to that show? Because it's history based. Did you play a role in that because of your interest in history?
Well, yeah, that time period, Mignonette. No, that it's not connected. Okay. No. To my interest in history. In fact, that the genesis for the album Mignonette was, we're going back to 2003, probably. I don't know, 2002, 3, 4, somewhere there.
Very early.
And I remember that I was living in Asheville and Scott was living in Mars Hill. And that's when those songs were written in that time period. What happened a decade later or more, we were approached by these Broadway producers who were fans, and they took the album and the idea and took it to a writer named John Logan, who wrote Gladiator. He wrote like James Bond film, and mm-hmm. he's just a very seasoned veteran screenwriter and story writer, remarkable talent. And he wrote what they call the book. Like every Broadway show, they write the book for it, which is kind of the story behind it,
and the script.
And so he took that, and you know he had a lot of questions for Scott and Seth about, you know, well, how you feel about this, how you feel about that. But he's the one who kind of went into that, took the original story of the Mignonette, which the book is called The Custom of the Sea by Neil Hansen, if anybody wants to read it. It's a great book. Scott had read it. So while we're writing Mignonette, while we were writing what became Mignonette, Scott was reading this book, and we would drive around, which is just the three of us, and just talk about this book every day. It's like Scott would talk about what he had read the day before or what he was currently reading. And so that is what became Mignonette, and that was the... That was the genesis for that.
I'm curious about getting back to your podcast, your history based podcast. Who do you think your audience is? Who have you found your audience to be?
That's a great question, Mike. If you can do the research and let me know, that would be awesome. I know I get a lot of support from our Avett fans. Who have been absolutely incredible. I think that it has gone further than that. I get the sense that it has spread a little further than that. Hoping,
go ahead.
Here's who I want to attract, or here's who I want to make a difference with Americans, citizens, a knowledge of their history, right? So that means I want the historically curious American citizen to, that this is the beauty of American History Hotline. It's 30 minutes. It's a smaller bite than if you're going to read a book or listen to The Road to Now.
And with that, we have to stop. Bob Crawford with the Avett Brothers American History Hotline on iHeartRadio.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.